Welcome to Two Bits, a podcast about coins and currency produced by the American Numismatic Association and hosted by Doug Mudd and Mitch Sanders.
I'm excited to hear what the last two of your choices are, or the top two. It's been interesting so far, Mitch.
I bet you can predict what they are. You may not be able to predict their order, but we haven't talked about this in advance, and I don't know what you're thinking, but I have a feeling that you can come up with the exact right guess as to what the two items are. But I won't hold you in suspense any longer. Let me get into my top two. And what I'm going to do, actually, I will hold you in suspense a little bit longer. To prolong the suspense, I'm going to give you my top two items in the Money Museum. But for the moment, I'm going to give them to you in chronological order. And after I've told you about both, then I will go back and tell you which one is my number one, which one is my number two. So here we go. Are you ready?
Yes.
All right, in chronological order, first item in my top two at the Money Museum is the 1804 dollar. Definitely a headliner at the Money Museum. Anytime anyone has a chance to see one, it's a special experience. It's a coin that has a lot of history and lore to it, in part because for about the first 75 years of American coinage history, we didn't make that many dollars. It was a denomination that it existed legally, but in practice, there were often big gaps. And even when it was made, it was not made in substantial quantity. And especially in the early period, 1794 to 1803, American dollars tended to be exported, because when Alexander Hamilton had figured out what a dollar should weigh, he was trying to match the Spanish milled dollar, which was the main currency in the American colonies and the new American states at the time. He did a really interesting and clever thing, which is he took a sample of the dollars that were in circulation and he weighed them in order to figure out what the coins should weigh. But by taking the sample from circulation, he was taking coins that were a little bit worn. So the coins ended up being a little bit light. So they ended up being exported. And so in 1803, coinage of silver dollars was ended. And no more were made, at least beyond minimal or beyond a pattern stage, until 1840. Okay, but we're talking about the 1804 dollar. So how did this come to pass? Well, for a long time, people knew that there were dollars dated 1804, but no one quite knew the reason why. It was thought maybe they were lost at sea or just ended up through attrition or melting. They ended up disappearing. We didn't know the reason why they existed. And there was also a strong reason to believe, based on mint practices, that although mint records indicated that there were dollars made in 1804, roughly 20,000, I think was the number, a lot of times the coins made in a year would have the date of an earlier year. So the 20,000 or so dollars made in 1804, every expectation was they were dated 1803, but then there were these few 1804 dollars around. No one quite knew why. But then in the early 1960s, the mystery was solved. Ken Brissett and Eric Newman, in a book called The Fantastic 1804 Dollar, figured out the story based on the characteristics of the coins and then based on some items that became available for sale at the time. And so the story, as they unraveled it, was that the 1804 dollars were made not in 1804 or any time contemporaneous with their date, but they were made 30 years later in 1834, when there was a request by the State Department for a proof set of coins for diplomatic purposes. This was a not uncommon thing to do, and there were some diplomatic missions to some Asian countries, and the State Department wanted coins for this purpose. So the Mint Director at the time gathered the relevant materials for this set, but the dollar coin was not currently being made. So he looked back to see when was the last time dollar coin was made. He saw the last time the dollar coin was made was 1804. So in executing these proof sets, he made or ordered to be made dollars dated 1804, not realizing that the dollars made in 1804 had actually been dated 1803. So the 1804 dollars that we have now, or at least about half of them, came from this diplomatic purpose. Actually, one of them went to the King of Siam, who was the father of the king portrayed in the movie and the play, The King and I. So the 1804 dollar, it has this really captivating story. It was made, definitely not made in the year of its creation, but it was made for a legitimate, if misunderstood, purpose. in the form of diplomacy. Now, there were some restrikes made later in the late 1850s and early 1860s. I find those a lot less interesting because they were made on a restrike basis instead of as part of this original diplomatic mission. The one in the A&A Money Museum is one of the originals, the class one, and it's such an interesting story and a big mystery for a long time until the mystery was finally solved, and the coin is an example of that history. And one thing, actually, I would ask you about, my understanding is that this coin, this particular coin, had some mishaps of its own. It was stolen, recovered, and then later donated to the Money Museum. But I don't know the detailed backstory on that.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the neat things about these coins is that you've got the general story, but then there's particular stories that go with these, especially these truly rare pieces. You know, as you alluded to, there are basically different types of the $1804. There's a type one, a type two, and a type three. And it was a big mystery of why the different types existed and how this occurred. And as you said, with the fantastic $1804, that the mystery was cleared up. And it turns out that a small number of these pieces were produced for the State Department. The Cohen specimen at the A&A is a type one, and it was actually stolen from Willis DuPont, who owned the coin back in the 1960s. So somebody actually broke into his house in 1967, and they stole a large portion of his collection, including this $1804. And what was interesting is that in 1993, it was recovered at the A&A, actually, because somebody came into the museum asking to have their coin identified, and it turned out to be an $1804. And one of our numismatists on staff at the time was able to identify it, and they called the FBI, made sure they got the information for who this person was and all this, and there was a whole sting operation that was conducted. Unfortunately, they weren't able to figure out who the ultimate thief was involved in this, but they were able to get the person who brought the coin in and some other people that were involved in this trying to sell the coin.
So they brought it to the A&A to be authenticated. Was it knowing that it was stolen goods, or do we know what their plans were or what their intentions were?
That's something that I'm not really clear about. It seemed that they were trying to get the coins authenticated and then make it into a discovery coin. I don't believe that the person who had the coin realized just how well known these pieces were, i.e., you can't just bring an 1804 genuine piece in and expect that it would be a totally unknown piece.
Right. Everyone's going to know from its overall condition and idiosyncratic characteristics, they're going to know which specimen it is. It's like a Van Gogh painting or a Rembrandt painting.
Right.
If it's been stolen, people are going to know what it is. That may be less obvious with coins, but the way people study coins, that's something that if you know what to look for, you can figure out which specimen it is.
Yeah, it comes down to, it's very similar to artwork, like you say, when you only have six examples of the type one specimens and no new ones have appeared in more than 80 years, it's unlikely that you're going to have one pop out of the woodwork. So soon after the coin was recovered, Willis DuPont actually donated it to the A&A, and that's why it's part of our collection. It was a very generous donation, and it's a great piece to be able to display. We take it to most of our conventions, and we have it as part of our museum showcase as a regular feature. It's always really popular. I would say probably about a quarter of the people that come into the museum showcase during one of our conventions asks about the $4 million dollar. You know, where can I find that?
Yeah, I would think that that's one of the two coins that attracts the most notoriety, and I expect the other one is the one that I'm going to talk about in just a moment. But it's so interesting that the coin has a history in terms of how and why it was produced, and then that individual example has its own history of being owned and stolen and then recovered. It's quite compelling.
Yeah.
And think about everything that the coin has experienced, and to still be in such good shape after almost 200 years and having been stolen and, you know, perhaps not treated as well as it would be by a collector or certainly by a museum. And it's amazing that it was recovered after 3 decades of being unknown, its whereabouts unknown.
Well, and it is interesting that particular piece is not one of the finest examples of the type one. It actually shows quite a bit of wear. It circulated at some point or another. We're not sure exactly who the first Eastern potentate to receive the coin was, but at some point it must have been sold out of their collection, and it circulated around in the public enough to get the examples of wear. It's one of the pieces that we have on display in our virtual exhibits and in our exhibits at headquarters. So you can actually see it close up and you can see just the amount of wear that it did see. So this is back to one of the things that we've talked about before, the idea of honest wear, a coin that has actually seen some sort of circulation and therefore has become a real coin as opposed to something that never actually left a collector's hands or left the mint. But the fact that these coins had belonged to Eastern royalty is interesting in and of itself, especially when you can read some of the letters that still exist in the State Department archives and other archives where they describe taking sets out to the Far East in order to be able to give them as special presentation gifts.
And what a nice gift it was. Yeah, as we see almost 200 years later, people are still talking about it.
Yep.
All right, now I'll move on to the second item in my top two, again, going in chronological order for now. Another coin with a mysterious background and a lot of interesting things that happened to it between then and now, which is the 1913 Liberty Nickel. I doubt that you're surprised that this is on my list, because it is not only one of the most compelling coins in the Money Museum collection, but one of the most compelling coins in the hobby. And what makes it so unusual is that it exists, but it was not supposed to exist. Liberty nickels were made from 1883 to 1912. The Buffalo nickel design commenced in 1913. So the end of the Liberty Nickel series was supposed to be in 1912. But in the late 19-teens, there started to appear advertisements that a person named Samuel Brown was trying to buy 1913 Liberty Nickels. And then a year or so later, he displayed at the 1920 ANA convention, so we're coming up on the 100th anniversary of this happening, he displayed a 1913 Liberty Nickel, and later he would display five 1913 Liberty Nickels, which is all that are known. There are only five known. Now, this was an interesting move on his part, because the story that people later pieced together, Samuel Brown had been a mint employee, and the story that's been pieced together is that these 1913 Liberty Nickels were clandestinely made at the Philadelphia Mint. He didn't buy them from people who had them in the public. He'd had them the whole time, is the speculation, which entirely makes sense. And then he displayed them at the 1920 ANA convention. It's a coin that shouldn't exist, but obviously does, and now we have a good sense of how it happened. But there's another layer to the story that helps to make it really interesting. So there were five made, or five known, and then for a while, one of them, its whereabouts were unknown. It was thought that, well, it wasn't really known what had happened. It was in the possession of a coin dealer named George Walton, who had been killed in a car accident. And he had a 1913 Liberty Nickel, and his heirs had a 1913 Liberty Nickel, but it was thought to be a fake. And I guess Walton was the kind of guy who might have had a real one and a fake one. It's like somehow this story checked out based on his history and his general behavior. So for a long time, there were four of the five known, and the fifth was unknown, but there was this fake out there that was connected to someone who had owned the fifth one. And then in 2003, at the ANA convention in Baltimore, there was going to be a reunion of the 1913 Liberty Head Nickels that were known. The four known 1913 Nickels, Liberty Nickels, were at the Baltimore convention. And then the heirs, the family of George Walton, brought the fake nickel to be part of the reunion, even though it wasn't considered to be real. But when people were looking at the coins and looked at the nickel that was thought to be fake, it was realized this actually was the missing fifth 1913 Liberty nickel. It had been stored, like, they tried to get it authenticated, and they were told it was fake, and it was sitting in a closet for decades, and finally it was reunited with all the others, and it was a pretty big deal. I happened to be at that convention. I remember the announcement. It was huge news. And so this coin was already really interesting. Then it had this very unusual story, made it even more interesting. And the ANA has one of the five coins from the BB collection. But the 1913 Liberty Nickel is definitely a coin that would attract the interest of any numismatist who's heard the story.
Absolutely. It's a coin that I find compelling, in part because I've had a lot to do with the story the last few years. When the 1913 nickel reunion occurred in 2003 at Baltimore, that was something that Beth Deischer, the editor of Coin World at the time, was involved with very closely. She had organized this program of, hey, let's get the four known pieces together and at the same time announce that they were looking for the fifth piece, and there would be a reward offered, which was offered. It was a $10,000 reward offered for any information that would lead to the discovery of where the missing piece was. And at this point, the Walton family got involved, and it turns out that George Walton had an amazing collection of not just coins, but also militaria, all sorts of things. He apparently had more than one warehouse full of materials. But he was a very active collector as well as a dealer. He was very active in the South, and he used to go to a large number of the conventions there, and he would often set up displays featuring the 1913 nickel, which was one of his favorite pieces, and he loved to show it around. And it turns out that in 1962, he was on his way to one of the shows with his collection, his materials for sale, and he got into a car accident, a fatal car accident, unfortunately. And at that point, everything was brought together, and the collection was given to the family. So it turns out he did not have a family of his own, but he did have brothers and sisters, and they received the items, his mother did, and they checked on this 1913 nickel. It turns out that they sent the coin to an expert, and the expert mistakenly identified it as a fake, basically because they'd never seen a real 1913 nickel before, and the 1913 nickel, because it was created, like I like to say, on a dark and stormy night at the Philadelphia Mint, did not have some of the characteristics you would expect for a normal nickel of the time. The planchet had not been prepared in precisely the same way, and there were some characteristics of it that just don't fit what a genuine piece of the time should look like. Well, they sent it back, and the family took the coin, and literally it was put into a closet and forgotten about for many years. In the meantime, there was all sorts of rumors about the whereabouts of the coin. So apparently people used to go to the crash site and use a metal detector and try to see if they could find the coin at the side of the road or something like that. There were rumors that there was another coin. You know, at some point, because of the missing coin rumor, I believe it was thought that, well, if there was five coins and there's one missing, there must be six coins, not realizing that one of those five is missing. And fast forward to 2003. At that time, I was working at the Smithsonian Institution as a collection manager, and Beth Deischer called me and asked me if it was possible that the Smithsonian Institution would be willing to have the 1913 nickel from the National Numismatic Collection put on display at this reunion. And it seemed like a great idea to me, and I had to run it up the flagpole and make sure that the curator of the National Numismatic Collection, Dr. Richard Doty at the time, and then our bosses above were all okay with this. And after some negotiation and all that, we did get permission to bring the coin to the Baltimore show. So it was quite an event to get the Smithsonian piece up to Baltimore. I was in a special vehicle with Smithsonian security. We delivered to the loading dock, and then the coin was put on display. Once the coin was put on display, it turned out that the family had come forward, and they decided, why not? We'll bring Uncle George's coin out and have it checked, because to our knowledge, that was the coin that he carried around that everybody thought was real. So it was brought to the Baltimore show, and a group of six numismatists, expert in the U.S. coin series of the time, were put together for a midnight viewing, basically. So I was there because I was required to be with the piece when it was taken out of its secure display. So I was present while the six experts examined the coins, and they determined that the fifth piece, the Walton specimen, was a genuine 1913 B nickel. And that created a great furor. Everybody was excited. We were all smiling and basically shaking hands and saying, this is really great. We've solved this mystery. And that was then announced the next day, and the coin was put on display with the others, finally being reunited for the first time since 1942, when the coins had been split up as a set and sold individually.
And so seeing them all together, going back to the 1960s authentication, that where the coin was incorrectly called false, as you said, because no one had seen one. But when you see them all together, then you can discern the characteristics that they all have in common, and that they're not, if you saw those characteristics on a regular Liberty nickel, you might well call it fake, but seeing the way the 1913s were made, it just fit in with the rest. And once people started to lay eyes on the coin who had seen the other coins, and then to be able to actually compare them, then they were able to make the determination.
Yeah, it made for a very exciting story, and a big splash across the numismatic news. Plus, in the general news cycle, it was a big hit as well. You know, a $2 million coin resurfaces after 40 years. Now, what was fun for me was that my connection to the 1913 continued, because soon after the Walton specimen was identified as genuine, the Walton family decided to ask the ANA if they'd be willing to display the coin along with the McDermott specimen of the 1913 V nickel, which belonged to the ANA at the time. So the Walton specimen was brought to the ANA and put on display. And I was involved in creating a display for that in 2004. So the ANA Money Museum was able to display two examples of the 1913 V nickel for many years. We actually had the Walton specimen for 10 years until the family decided to sell their piece in 2013. So we returned it to them, and they sold it. It sold for about $3.15 million and went into private hands again. In the meantime, for a short while, we had the distinction of being able to display three of the 1913 nickels for about a year during the mid-2000s, which was a pretty big milestone when it comes to the top end of U.S. coins. To continue the story, after it had been sold, the coin went into private hands. And if we fast forward to basically 2018, a collector who at the time wanted to be anonymous and wanted his collection to be known as the Dazzling Rarities Collection purchased the Walton specimen, and he very generously decided to allow the ANA to display the coin. So it's made a full circle over the last couple decades, going from being lost to being put on display at the ANA, being sold into private hands and then returning to the ANA after a hiatus of basically 5 years. And it's currently on display with the McDermott specimen again in our marquee display area, where we have the 1804 dollar, the 1913 nickel, and our 1792 half-deen display.
Yet another reunion involving a 1913 Liberty nickel, now that you have those two on display again. That's a really cool story and a good entree to my reveal of which of these two rarities is my number one and which is my number two. I'll tell you how I was thinking about this in general. These two coins, for a long time, they went back and forth as to which coin had the highest auction price in history for a coin. They're at the top of the list. Maybe only a few other coins can even be discussed in the same conversation as really compelling issues. Both are unusual in that they really shouldn't exist. The 1804 dollar was made 30 years after it was dated for diplomatic purposes. The 1913 Liberty nickel, the series of Liberty nickels, should have ended in 1912. It was only through the actions on, as you described it, the dark and stormy night at the Philadelphia Mint with some shenanigans that 1913 nickels ended up being created. The nickel is slightly rarer in that there are only five 1913 nickels versus eight class one 1804 dollars, both super rare. And some of those specimens are unavailable because they're in museums. But the nickel's a little bit rarer. Here's one way that I was thinking about this. And one thing that loomed large in my mind is that I always feel like the 1913 Liberty nickel deserves a little bit of an asterisk next to it, because it shouldn't exist. And in a way, the 1804 dollar shouldn't exist either, but the 1913 Liberty nickel shouldn't exist. It does exist because it was made clandestinely on the dark and stormy night, as you described it. It was an unofficial issue, and the 1804 dollar was not a coinage issue, but it was still an official issue. The 1913 Liberty nickel was an unofficial issue. It was made at the Philadelphia Mint, but not really by the Philadelphia Mint, because it was not an official mint product. And one piece of evidence about this is that the mint doesn't want it back. There are lots of coins like the 1964 Peace Dollar or the 1974 Aluminum Cents that are considered to have left the mint illegally. And so if they are out there, the mint would want them back. But the 1913 Liberty Nickel, the mint doesn't want it back because, as far as the mint knows, it doesn't really exist. It's not, right. It was not something that was produced by the mint. So
it wasn't an official product of the mint. So.
Right. And so it never existed from that official perspective. So its possession, there couldn't be anything inappropriate in someone coming into possession of it. Again, it's the fact that it was produced illegally, you know, that's obviously an issue, but it's not an official issue. So it's not something that the mint wants back. This was something that I consider to be important. I still do consider it to be important. And until about 5 minutes ago, that was going to be the reason why I was going to put the 1804 dollar in the top spot on the list. However, hearing your story about the reunion of the nickels and hearing about your personal connection to the nickel now on both sides, when you were the chaperone for the Smithsonian piece and then arranging the display of the Walton specimen at the ANA. It was always a close call. I was going to give the edge to the 1804 dollar because of the 1913 Liberty nickel asterisk. But right here in real time, hearing your story, Doug, I changed my mind. I'm going to say, based on its story and your story, the most compelling item in the ANA Money Museum is the 1913 Liberty nickel.
Well, I think in a lot of ways I'd have to agree with you, Mitch. Just the one coin that I've had more personal connections brought up to me about in the ANA collection is the 1913 nickel. An example is just 7 or 8 years ago, a visitor to the Money Museum in Colorado Springs came up to me and said, you know, I have a special connection to that coin. And it was the McDermott specimen, the one that actually belongs to the ANA. And he brought out a picture. It was an old black and white photo, and it was a newspaper clipping showing this boy and Mr. McDermott with the 1913 nickel between them in its plastic holder, and it was talking about this super fabulous, very expensive nickel. I think they said it was $10,000 at the time, but this is dated 1955 or 56, I believe. And it turns out that boy was this visitor, and it was one of the highlights of their numismatic career to have actually held the coin at that time next to Mr. McDermott.
Definitely a special coin. It's a special opportunity to see it whenever you can. And that story and all the other stories that go into its background, I feel it was a close call and it almost went the other way, but I feel good about this choice of the 1913 Liberty Nickel as the most compelling piece in the Money Museum.
Certainly an excellent set of five coins. And the runner-up was actually a great choice as well. So I had a lot of fun. I hope you did as well.
It was a lot of fun to think about and to figure out what were the cream of the crop. There's so much interesting stuff in the Money Museum. And with material like that, anyone putting together a top five list, they're going to be able to do a nice job because of the material and the way it's displayed and presented, which is a tribute to you and the association that all these things are there for people to enjoy. And this is just one element of what's at the Money Museum. There's so much else about money and its connection to history and society and economics and so much else. So this top five is a good starting point, but there is, of course, so much more.
Yeah, and I always encourage people to go to our website because we have so much material on themoney.org. If you look on that page, there's the museum part of the site. We have things like our Tales from the Vault and then our virtual exhibits and others where you can find out all about these coins and also others as well, including sets that you may never have heard about, but there's some really cool things to learn about in numismatics. So that's what makes it fun.
We should also mention that the items that we talked about today, we will include on the podcast webpage, money.org/podcast. So to check out in more detail the things that we've talked about today.
Well, I think that's it for this episode of Two Bits.
Yes, I think so. Thank you, Doug, for the validation of my list. And thanks to everyone for listening, and stay well.